Hi, and welcome to episode 58 of Forecast, a podcast about climate science and climate scientists. Your host is Michael White, Nature's editor for climate science. This is Vaughn and Miles White talking. Today is kind of different. Instead of one interview, we have three interviews. Coming to you from the 11th Graduate Climate Conference. We're interviewing Honoree Joy, Jennifer Carmen, and Molly Keough. And I had parkour class today. We did vaults today at parkour class.
And I am Mike White, Nature's editor for climate science. That was my six-year-old son, Vonnen, doing the intro. So, like Vonnen said, today is a bit different in the sense that we're doing three short interviews. This arose from contacts I got from Henri Drake, who's a regular listener, saying, you know, very nicely that I really wasn't living up to my initial promise to be interviewing grad students as well as senior people in the field. And he mentioned that there was this upcoming meeting called the 11th Graduate Climate Conference, held alternately between MIT and the University of Washington. And we ended up working out an interview schedule where we had three people from the GCC, including Henri and two other graduate students, and recorded while they were at the meeting during the social outreach or the media outreach time. So we have Henri, who works on physical oceanography, and Jennifer Carmen, who's working on kind of like the psychology of how people make decisions about environmentalism and climate change. So that's related to what I do in my job, but would be handled more by the people who do the neurology and psychology part of nature. And then a really interesting interview with Molly Keough, who's a PhD student at Tulane, and Molly's working on sediment delivery in deltaic systems down there in the Mississippi River Delta. They're each about 20 minutes long, so I mean, overall, it's a long episode, but you can kind of pop in for one or the other, and hopefully all three of them might be interested to try to get into some of the issues that are facing graduate students today, both in terms of advising and careers, sexual harassment, and a few other issues as well. So I hope you like the format. Let me know what you think. If you'd like to hear more shows that are like this, multi-part interviews, could try to work some of those in the future. Something else I'd like to do from time to time now is to talk about papers that I've handled at Nature that have come out recently and give you maybe a bit of an insight into why I chose to pursue those papers. So one of them that came out on October 26th was a paper by Matthew Wise, who I believe actually is a graduate student, called Evidence of Marine Ice Cliff Instability in Pine Island Bay from Iceberg Keel Plow Marks. And they're looking at these plow marks left by icebergs in Pine Island Bay from, you know, about 12,000 years ago, so quite a while ago, after a fairly in-depth analysis coming to the conclusion that they're most consistent with the marine ice cliff instability mechanism. Why, you might ask, would we care about this at Nature? The reason is that there's a couple of papers by Rob DeCanto, Richard Alley, and David Pollard, and others inspired by work of Jeremy Bassis and his colleagues, I mean, sort of suggesting that this mechanism of marine ice cliff instability could cause extremely rapid retreat and destabilization of ice shelves and then rapid mass loss from Antarctica, for example, potentially over centennial timescales, leading to many, many meters of ice loss. And it's gotten a huge amount of attention, some from the glaciological community, with the criticism that there isn't good evidence geologically that this ever took place. And here we have this work from 12,000 years ago that in fact, it does seem to have taken place. So that's why I sent it out. It's sort of a confirmation of this interesting and potentially very important mechanism. Then we had a paper that I actually raised with Henri in our discussion, which is called Abyssal Ocean Overturning Shaped by Seafloor Distribution by Casimir de la Verne. And this came out just a little while ago, and on the 9th of November, 2017, making the point that the distribution of the seafloor at particular depths has this huge influence on the way that the deep and the abyssal ocean circulates, and that it results in this this shadow layer between the upper ocean and the lower ocean, where you have the potential for very, very long-term storage of, for example, carbon. And it was the latest in a series of papers that have been coming out, not just in Nature, but in other venues, showing the importance of the bottom of the ocean for ocean mixing and turbulence, and in this case, major ocean circulation patterns. So I thought that was a really interesting insight into how the ocean circulation takes place, what's driving it, not just from the surface. Let's go ahead and kick it off now. Me talking with Honoree Drake about the GCC itself and physical oceanography. Honoree Drake from MIT and the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution PhD program. Thanks for coming on Forecast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael.
You're in the midst, I guess you're wrapping up now, day one of the 11th version of the Graduate Climate Conference. Can you give me just a brief background on what the conference is and how it got going in the first place?
Sure. So I guess, as you said, this is the 11th year. So it's traditionally been alternatively hosted by University of Washington graduate students, and this year is MIT students. And actually, it's MIT, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and also Harvard is involved now too. But I think historically it was just MIT and University of Washington. I don't actually know, we were talking about this earlier with some attendees, so we don't actually know how it started in the first place.
Now, I can imagine a lot of reasons for doing it. I mean, principal among them would be to have an environment where you're away from all of the pompous gas bags that can that can sometimes dominate scientific conferences. I mean, is that your experience so far, that it's sort of just a nice place to be with your more immediate colleagues?
Yes, absolutely. That's a big part of it for me, is that, you know, you go to all these other sort of national conferences, but if you look at the percentage of attendees that are graduate students and the percentage of people who ask questions that are graduate students, it's sort of dominated by these senior faculty members with strong opinions and sort of intimidates younger students. So I think it's nice to have a place for us to just sort of mingle with each other and sort of know that it's lower stakes.
You know, I was at a Gordon conference a little while ago, and the organizers there did this great thing where they would only take questions in the discussion section if the first question came from a young scientist or a grad student, which worked extremely well. And I had the other experience of being at a meeting where I suggested this strategy, and they said, you know, yes, we're going to do that, but if we do it too early, then the senior scientists will disengage because they don't feel like they can get their opinions in quickly enough. I mean, do you feel that this is a good way around that, to sort of avoid those sort of discussions entirely? Or is there also a big benefit to trying to bring out the voice of the younger scientists in a bigger meeting?
I don't know about the bigger meetings, but in our department at MIT, actually, we have this sort of main climate talk every week on Mondays. And we have this policy where the first three questions come from graduate students. And that's actually worked really well. You know, every time we get three students with questions, they're always good questions, and it always leaves enough time for, you know, three or four questions from the faculty. And yet, the big reason why we implemented that this year for the first time was because, you know, there was a few faculty members with strong opinions about, you know, some of the science, and so they would sort of dominate the questions.
Now, you're at a meeting which has this really interesting sounding mix of research ranging all across the spectrum of climate science, going into society and psychology, the basic physical sciences, things like that. What do you sense as being the level of intellectual snobbery, let's say, from the more physical the more physical science part of it? You know, because it has this reputation where I'm sure you've heard discussions where people have said that everything else is just applied physics and things like this. I mean, what's your take on that at this particular meeting?
The way we've structured the different sessions, so, you know, there's we started with a session on climate dynamics, and then we went into a session on policy and human dimensions, but we started off each session with sort of a 10-minute primer on that subject. So that was sort of to try and make everything a little more accessible to everyone. So I started the climate dynamics session with sort of a primer on monsoons, just so that everyone was sort of on the same playing field. And they did the same thing for policy and human dimensions. And I think that sort of helped everyone get to a level playing field. And I don't think we've really had too much of the sort of intellectual snobbery from the physical climate scientists, but
that's
maybe
fantastic.
You can ask the other interviewers.
How they feel. Yeah. All right. So you personally, I've just learned looking at your background that you're from the San Francisco Bay Area. Where exactly are you from?
So I'm actually from San Francisco, from Cow Hollow, so right by the Golden Gate.
How's the weather?
Here or there?
there. I mean, I know, I mean, the climate, the microclimates there are just ridiculous, right? And I know some areas are in the fog belt and some are out. Were you in or out?
So we were sort of perpetually in the fog belt, and we'd have strong winds coming up from Christie Field through the gap. You know, I prefer that. Even though we were sort of swamped in fog all the time, I prefer that to having a real winter like we do here in Boston.
So. Yeah, right now it's about, I don't know, 59 degrees, kind of a little bit overcast. Of course, we did just have the season of raging wildfires too. So, you know, there's a mix of that as well. Yeah. You know, San Francisco has a reputation, deserved or otherwise, that the public school system there is not as strong as one might hope. Were you in public schools? Were you in private schools? What was your experience like going through high school there?
Yeah, so I can't speak much to that because I did go to private school. My mother's French, so that's why my name's Henri. Uh-huh. And she was had a very strong opinion that I had to go to a French school for my upbringing.
Oh, did you go to EB?
No, I went to the other French school, so International High School, which has the French baccalaureate. So I actually did all of my K-12 schooling in French as the primary language, even in my science classes and stuff.
So that's fascinating because I have got a good friend who works at EB, the Ecole Bilingual. I'm mangling that word, of course, but it's the French-speaking school, bilingual school over here in the East Bay, and they're having the experience that they're getting parental blowback because the mathematics isn't seen as being as strong as it could be. But you went on to get your bachelor's degree from Haverford in mathematics. Did you feel like you had a strong math background coming out of that high school experience?
Yeah, so that's actually really funny that you say that because I actually got placed in the sort of the remedial calculus when I started in college. But it actually ended up being just because I sort of failed the placement exam because I didn't understand any of the terms. I literally didn't know what the word integral meant in English and derivative and stuff like that. But then I sort of explained it to the professors and, you know, got placed in the...
Yeah, that's bizarre. Like, you would think that the French teachers would have figured out that there might be a potential problem here. Or they really just were teaching it purely in the French curriculum with no awareness of the country they were teaching in.
I mean, I guess we took the GREs, so we had to sort of teach ourselves on some degree. But yeah, definitely there's a little bit of adjustment when I first got there, just sort of reteaching myself the vocab.
Well, now you've obviously thrived in that quantitative environment because you're working with Raf Ferrari, but it's got to be one of the, I don't know, top three research groups in the world looking at physical oceanography. What was your pathway from your bachelor's in mathematics to being in Raf's lab?
Yeah, so there was an intermediate step there that was really important. Basically, I my senior year of undergrad, I was in the math department and I was working on sort of these theoretical problems for my summer research before senior year and also for my senior thesis, and they just weren't really exciting me very much. So I took this elective in oceanography taught by a chemical oceanographer at Haverford, and she gave this really excellent lecture on physical oceanography and especially focused on the overturning circulation or the you know, the thermohaline circulation, the global conveyor belt. And it really fascinated me. So I met with her after class and asked her about, you know, jobs in the field or sort of how to move forward as sort of a mathematician in this field. And I actually ended up applying for a bunch of research assistantship positions at GFDL and Princeton University.
You mean not being in grad school, but actually being an employee? Is that what you mean? Or in a graduate program?
Yeah, so I didn't know enough about the field to commit to a graduate program. So I wanted a little tester. So I sort of just cold call emailed a bunch of people at GFDL who did sort of computational modeling work.
You mean people like Steve Griffey? Is that kind of crowd or other folks?
Yeah, exactly. So Steve Griffey, Sonia Legg, Stephen Pacala, Jorge Sarmiento. and I actually ended up getting a position with Jorge Sarmiento and Steve Griffey as my advisors.
That's GFDL. Not so bad.
Yeah, it was really lucky, honestly.
Now, something that's happened, at least in my time in Nature, which is 8 going on 9 years now, is that we've seen quite a few submissions coming in from, you know, from your group and people that have been tied to your group, like Max Nakarishan down in Tasmania. Just looking at, I don't know if you call it a revision to our understanding necessarily, but just the concept that it's not all wind-driven and that the bottom of the ocean, either the topographic variability or now we had a paper in Nature looking at the depth distribution of the ocean floor, as being these critical processes that are controlling the abyssal ocean circulation. I mean, what's your take on that development? Does it actually seem new to you from the time that you've been in grad school or going back into your initial exposure to physical oceanography? Or has that been percolating or an accepted process for a long time?
Yeah. So actually, the reason I ended up choosing working with Raphael Ferrari at MIT was because of this problem. So I went to Ocean Sciences to present in 2016 to present my work at Princeton. And I sat through a session on... I guess it was called the abyssal overturning circulation or something like that. And Raphael Ferrari gave, well, actually, Walter Monk gave the first talk.
Oh, brilliant. I've never heard him speak.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was really, really wonderful to have him there. So he talked about sort of moon and tides and mixing. And then Raphael Ferrari went next and talked about sort of this new paradigm for the abyssal overturning circulation that is driven by internal wave breaking and mixing along the boundaries. And I had sort of already known a little bit about that because I was studying sort of a different part of the overturning circulation. And I was aware of, you know, some of these early papers by Henry Stommel and Walter Monk on the abyssal circulation, but it seemed like it had sort of not really gotten to a full theory. So those are sort of, you know, they're bulk theories, sort of one-dimensional theories. They don't explain a lot of the effects. And then you have sort of this further step that in the 90s, when they actually tried to observe the mixing that would sustain this kind of circulation, they didn't find it, at least not at the right depths. And so there has been this effort in the late 90s and the early 2000s and up to now even to sort of explain how you reconcile these observations of the mixing that you know drives the circulation with the actual observed circulation. And so, you know, I saw this problem. I saw that Raph had this new way of looking at it, and it was pretty clear from his talk, which was sort of using this idealized bathtub-shaped model. it was clear that it was an interesting idea, but so far removed from the real ocean. So it was sort of obvious that there was a next step that he would need someone to do. I reached out, and you know, now I'm working on sort of taking that paradigm and using it in sort of a more realistic model with actual topography and stuff like that. So,
you know, I think I saw one of your animations at this great Antarctic climate hack I went out a little while ago. It was organized by Joellen Russell and Nancy Bertler and Tom Bracegirdle. And I think it was an animation showing the movement of the circumpolar deep water on Antarctica up onto and over the continental shelf. And if I remember this correctly, first of all, it was like just so cool to see what in retrospect seems totally obvious, which is it's a spiral because the Earth is rotating. And would you tend to see it in the way that you just described, which are these bathtub diagrams with our zonal means? And what you're sort of probing here is the degree to which these very, not very localized, but the local instances where you have very strong upwelling driven by these eddy driven processes. Where do you see that work going, and how is that level of insight into the way this takes place going to inform our broader understanding of how the Southern Ocean circulates and mixes?
I guess what you're talking about is there's sort of this disconnect between sort of observations, which, you know, often are sort of local process type observations or maybe, you know, global tracer fields or something, which are really three-dimensional and have the real topography and the real asymmetries in it, versus this two-dimensional latitude depth theory that sort of came out in the 2000s and up to now.
Yeah.
With this paper, we were really trying to explain that this three-dimensional aspect to the circulation is really important, that it's localized, it's not sort of uniform like the two-dimensional theory suggests. And I have more work hopefully on the way that sort of supports that even more. And I think, you know, I was actually reading one of Max Nikarashin, you mentioned him earlier.
Yeah.
So they have this sort of, you know, another two-dimensional theory for the overturning. And I think the way to move forward is sort of going forward in steps. So, you know, right now it's two-dimensional, but you can make it sort of two-dimensional, but with two different basins and sort of see how, you know, how the Pacific and the Atlantic interact. And I think Andrew Thompson has a paper that attempts to do this as well. It's going to be really hard to get, you know, a full three-dimensional theory for the overturning just because the math doesn't really, it gets really nice when you sort of can average zonally, but it gets pretty ugly otherwise. So,
well, I mean, it sounds like you're talking about some kind of a hierarchical approach where you could have these three-dimensional simulations for particular time slices or cases, but building off zonal mean to a bi-basin approach and working in between those different scales?
Yeah, so I think that's the way forward. I don't know exactly what it'll look like. This is something I've been thinking a lot about, is how to make sort of analytical progress with the equations.
Yeah.
Because you can always just sort of brute force it with a climate model, but you're not really sure that you're understanding what's going on in that case.
This is very far out in the future, but if this comes to pass, this approach you're talking about, what do you think that is wrong about our current perception of Southern Ocean circulation? Like, what do you think is going to be a fundamental change in how we understand the way that the oceans either circulate or store heat or release heat or CO2?
One of the big stories there is a lot of people have been thinking about what happens when you change the winds. So we've observed that the winds have changed either in magnitude or the latitude of the maximum winds in the Southern Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the part of the Southern Ocean circulation is driven by these winds. So if you change the winds, you can think about how that's going to change the circulation. And, you know, the Southern Ocean is where a lot of the heat gets taken up. It's a lot, where a lot of carbon is either released or taken up at different latitudes.
Right, right.
So getting that signal right is really important for the mean climate, for changes in climate, for paleoclimate. But right now, you know, people have these climate model studies where they sort of change the winds and see what happens, and they have some theory. But I don't think that's really super mature. You know, there's this question of sort of, so originally there was a result where you change the winds and it just sort of linearly goes with the overturning. And then people realize that these mesoscale eddies were actually sort of countering that effect. And so there's a question of, is it, you know, completely compensating for the increase from the winds?
Mm-hmm,
or is it just a partial compensation? So trying to get that number right is really important. And I'm just not convinced you can really do that in the two-dimensional, you know, current paradigm.
I mean, that seems like a question you'd really need to probe with an eddy resolving model.
Yeah, and so that's what people have done. But, you know, even in the eddy resolving models, those are so expensive, you can only really explore so many different parameter regimes. So getting an analytical model, I think that's where the strength is for doing, you know, either long time scale problems or even just sort of exploring parameter regimes. In any resolving model is not going to be the right tool. So having sort of a theory or sort of an intermediate step would be really useful.
And then, you know, one question I wonder about with grad students at the current time is the kind of career advice you're getting. You've written that your goal is to be working in research at a major U.S. institution. But I mean, I guess probably you and your colleagues know that most of you will not end up in a tenure track job. Is that discussed among the advisors? How are your advisors and other faculty talking with grad students? Or what's the discussion like when you think about the career ahead of you?
It's definitely a conversation that happens among students.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had those conversations with any faculty members.
That just seems wrong.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think that probably that's something that should be maybe talked about even during the application process before you really commit to something like this.
Man, I'm talking to students from Jerry Mitrovica's group, and they told me that of their entire graduating class, and I don't think I'm exaggerating, that they were the only two who went into academia. Then everyone else went into industry. Is that happening with the current cohort of MIT students?
At our open house, something that was sort of pretty reassuring to me was that they showed us, you know, a pie chart where I think after 5 years, half of the students went on to faculty positions. So those are probably numbers from, you know, 10, 15 years ago. That was a pretty promising thing because I know that the average is much lower than that.
I guess MIT might be a bit of an outlier in that.
Yeah. And I think the joint program in particular, just because oceanography is sort of a smaller field. So if you have one strong, really strong program, it sort of stands out maybe a little more.
Amir Drake from MIT and HUI, thanks a lot for the conversation. Oh, also, are you going to go to Ocean Sciences this year?
Yes, I will be there.
In Portland.
Giving a talk on Monday.
Fantastic. I will see you there.
All right, great.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Michael.
That was the first of the three interviews we're running today in Forecast. And now I'm moving on to my interview with Jennifer Carman. And, you know, I like this interview a lot because it relates to the psychology of climate change and how people make decisions, which is a topic that I don't really directly interact with at Nature. And we sort of start off with her really interesting and unusual background in religious studies and then move into her for research topics. Here we go, me and Jennifer Carman. Jennifer Carman from the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability. Thanks for coming on today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So a lot of the people I've had on this show over the past couple of years have had unusual backgrounds, but I'm pretty sure that I've never had anybody on who has your specific background. Kevin Anchikaitis kind of almost went into similar things, but you did get a BA in religion from Haverford back in 2006.
That is correct.
What does it mean to study religion as an undergraduate?
Well, it varies a lot from program to program. Like, a lot of people think that a religion major, and many programs it is, it's more of a theological perspective. Mm-hmm. Haverford is a small liberal arts college that is not religious. Well, it used to be Quaker, but it's not religiously affiliated.
Oh, okay.
So they approach it from a very scholastic perspective. Like, really, it was more like a combination of a history degree and an English degree and a philosophy degree in the context of how do people formulate religious beliefs, and how does the religious literature that they produce reflect those beliefs? So some people come into it with a theological sort of approach, but that's not necessarily something that's inherent to it. So the way that I approached it wasn't necessarily that way.
What was your different take on it?
One thing that I didn't put in my written bio was that I actually grew up in Birmingham, Alabama.
The Bible Belt.
The very buckle of the Bible Belt.
For our international listeners, What's the take on the Bible Belt, having grown up in the Bible Belt? What does that mean?
Well, so it means that it's very deeply religious and evangelical Christian. And I grew up in a Catholic household. So not in a Southern Baptist household. So it was religious, but different. So I grew up around a lot of people, with very strong religious convictions, and would say that the Bible is the word of God and everything is literal truth. And then you go to this small liberal arts college with this scholastic academic approach to academic literature, and it's kind of mind blowing.
Was it a bit shocking that people thought about religion in a different way?
Yeah. It was very funny because from the background that I had, I was like, when I was in high school, I was very much the skeptic who was like, well, what if the Bible isn't literally everywhere true?
Did you get that kind of reaction?
Yeah, and I had arguments with people about it all the time. And then when I was in college at this liberal arts school in the Northeast, where my roommate was like an atheist, from whom I learned the term culturally Jewish. I'd never heard it before growing up in Alabama. And she was like, how could you ever even believe that God exists? Like, what a rube, and how naive. And it was just so strange to be on the other side of it. And so I think approaching the religion major kind of helped me navigate that sort of cultural tension between those two groups of people, of that these texts are produced for a certain group of people with a specific purpose and with specific philosophical ideas behind that. And I think that sort of analytical sort of take is really carried over into a lot of the work that I've done. The other thing that I say often as sort of half a joke is that when I was in college, my undergraduate thesis was actually about the Book of Revelation, and I studied a lot of apocalyptic literature. And my concern was that, the religion major wasn't very practical, and I wasn't sure how to make that work. So now I study climate change.
The end of the world is nigh.
Yeah.
Clearly, you did find something to do before you got into climate science. So from 2009 to 13, you were in where I am now, the San Francisco Bay Area, working, it sounds like, more on the behavioral side of trying to understand people's energy use.
That's correct.
I mean, that sounds like economics. Is that, were you working with economists?
I was working with economists. I was working with economists and engineers, because I worked in program evaluation for demand side management. You may be familiar with this, or your listeners may be familiar with this, that there was a mandate that before any new energy power plants could be built, that energy conservation and efficiency measures needed to be put in place, and that utilities needed to prove that they were reducing the consumption that was out there as much as possible before they could build anything else. And so a lot of utilities have these energy efficiency and energy conservation programs. Evaluations are there to see if they did what they set out to do. And so
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of different kinds of program designs. And the ones that I focused on were ones that were related to communication and education and behavior change related programs. Like, what kind of information can we provide people? I did work on energy feedback and like real time energy feedback and normative feedback. And what kind of behavior changes did those lead to? And that ultimately led me to grad school because I personally felt like there was just more that could be done to try to change people's behavior. Mm-hmm. So I went and started looking at grad schools and I was like, well, where can I learn more about environment and behavior change? And that led me to the University of Michigan, where I work right now with Michelle Zint, and I also have Ray DeYoung on my committee. Ray, the first time that I spoke with him, I asked the question that I think a lot of people who are interested in behavior change ask. I was like, what is it going to take to get people to really change their behavior? And he came back to me and he said, why do you think that will ever happen?
Because, I mean, frankly, most people don't want to change their behavior and would react strongly against suggestions that they should change their behavior.
There was always kind of in my mind, like, well, what kind of event would it take that, you know, there's like the everybody wakes up and realizes that, you know, there's a need for serious change. And especially in the U.S., which is where all of my work has been.
Do you have the answer?
That it's so easy for us to, for every individual person to make their own answers. That it's very, it's really impossible to imagine that sort of unifying come to Jesus moment around an environmental issue.
I mean, or really any kind of issue. We think a lot about the issues of mass shootings and gun control in the U.S. And none of those events has had the cause or the outcome of changing people's attitudes about gun control or purchasing guns. If anything, it's increased their fervor for purchasing guns.
Yeah. Well, depending on the person and what, you know, what drives them and what they value and what their worldview is. So, yeah.
Is this yet another case of American exceptionalism, or do you think that universally people have in their minds very individualistic approaches or thought processes about how they would or would not react to a major climate event or change?
It's a really big question. But I feel like when you study behavior change, like, you deal with really big questions all the time. So I think that the individual level approach that I use is pretty mostly applicable to the United States. I hesitate to speak for other cultures, that like individualism is such an American value and it's such a something that we have such stake in here, that sort of individual level approach that I really focus on, that more psychological approach, is something that is more compatible with these more individualist values. But there certainly are cultures that are more collectivist value cultures. Some people care a lot about their neighbors and some people don't. There's just a lot of value in being individual and doing what works for you. And I think that in adaptation, because it affects so many people in such large swaths, that when people look out for only themselves, it can cause a lot of other problems.
I mean, I guess with your kind of work, there might be two major ways you're looking at this. One is just trying to understand people's thought processes. And the other is actually trying to change their thought processes. Which of these questions are both you and your group working on?
Probably both, because both, and answering the first question is really necessary to answering the second question well.
What is the dialogue now in the, I don't know what you call it, environmental psychology community about reproducibility? Because, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, there is this growing sense in psychology. I mean, I think that psychology is now in this process of devouring itself over issues of reproducibility. But I mean, the questions that arise with reproducibility are, which studies, if any, are actually reproducible? And how do you go about designing a robust experiment that will be resistant to extremely small differences in how the experiment is performed or who's doing the experiment, how cloudy it was that day, like all that kind of stuff. Can you just give me a feeling for what is the discussion right now in grad school about issues of environmental psychology and reproducibility?
That's like a huge debate within social science, to be honest, is how important is that question of reproducibility? Is it more important to produce like this replicable research, or is it more important to produce useful research? Because what is useful in one situation and what is useful in one study is not necessarily going to be what is useful in another study. And is that more important as social scientists to focus on? What I learned when I learned about methods, we didn't focus on reproducibility. We use the word reliability, and they're closely related, but I think that the idea of reliability is and validity, like that you're capturing what is universally true, is really difficult. And I think the fact that, like, and social science is so new, and I think is real, and there's like methods in social science are so scattered that I think that it's a much dicier struggle. Even like the methods that you use in social science are so much more scattered based on how you think truth is even, you know, how you even derive truth from your research is different from different social scientists, even in the same discipline. And the reproducibility question is important, especially when you're trying to communicate with natural scientists and who want more certainty.
I think that physical scientists now are getting very interested in trying to be certain about their uncertainties, and maybe less focused on trying to come up with a specific answer, but maybe embracing the wealth of answers that are possible for any question, which actually doesn't seem that different from what you're saying right now.
That's very heartening, because I think that it's really important to take into account that there are other ways of knowing and other ways of constructing truth. And I think that that's one of the really valuable contributions of social science, that it is that just because there's an answer doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best answer or the right answer for a certain set of circumstances. And I think that natural sciences can take account for those kind of contextual things too in a different way. But the context of human behavior just makes things so complicated that it's very hard. it's just very hard to make universal conclusions. Like, there's a paper that I read as a first year that basically said, like, there will never be a universal theory of human behavior.
So, oh, that seems very unlikely.
Well, this paper was very strongly worded. It said there will never be a unifying theory of social science. So what we should really focus on is practice. That's really our moral obligation as social scientists. And so, like, that's very controversial within social science, but it is something to think about. It's very thought-provoking as well.
So looking ahead in a fantasy world to the end of your PhD, not that finishing your PhD is a fantasy, let's assuming that you're going to get there. What questions do you hope you'll be able to answer? And do you have any initial suspicions about what those answers might be?
The goal that I have with my work is looking at climate change adaptation planning and really integrating more understanding of how behavior change works. So I guess in a wider sense, integrating thinking about the psychology of behavior change and into our, you know, planning and theories of social change. The example that I think of that I cite a lot is, like, if you look at the IPCC report of the strategies for climate change adaptation, one of the ones that it says for individuals and the one that's most psychology related is changes in values, worldviews, and norms across, like, society.
That sounds really hard.
It's huge. So integrating something so that we have some sort of way to approach that from a practical perspective.
So the practical perspective that I've come across is nudging. And I've gone to economics meetings and sat through a lot of nudging talks where people are trying to look at this, I guess you'd call it psychology, of how people make decisions based on the sorts of information that they have available to them, and finding that, you know, you can nudge their behavior on things like water or energy consumption by, like, low single digits. And to me, I see that and I'm like, okay, that's practical. It's immediate. It's probably right. We could probably roll it out in many locations, but it seems pretty small scale. Are there strategies that you see out there that could be used in a different way that might produce bigger outcomes?
That's such a good question, because that's literally what my dissertation is going to be about.
Oh, funny.
That's literally the question that I hope to answer with my dissertation.
Okay.
Which I just submitted the proposal to my advisor.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. But I don't know, because when I came back to school, I was really hoping to find the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I was really, like, because I saw these, like, nudging programs, I saw these normative programs, and I was really frustrated at these, like, very small percentages. And I was like, surely we can do better. But I don't know how. And this And then this, you have this question of climate adaptation, which is why I ended up in adaptation, mm-hmm. because adaptation really forces people to change. Mm-hmm. You know, the behaviors that you have to change because it's an emergency situation, because you have water filling your house. But then there's the behavior, then there's how, but how are you coping with that? And what are you going to do after? And how, what do you, and what might you do to prevent something like that from happening again? And those bigger social transformation questions, like how does that happen? How does that happen on the individual level? I think that there are people doing that. I think that a lot of that work towards social transformation is probably happening in advocacy. Mm-hmm. People who are pushing for transformation in their communities. There are people who do work who also do major behavior changes in their own lives, who, you know, believe in join eco villages and to undertake permaculture and all of these sort of.
It sounds very, very Bay Area.
Yeah. Well, actually, a lot of this work isn't just happening in the Bay
Area. No, I know, I'm sure.
Yeah. But it is a lot of people who have those kind of values too, right? Like that it is very values driven. Choosing to make those kind of choices with your life is something that not everybody will do. So the question of how that might happen on like a program design and implementation.
It's coming, right? You'll have the answer in 3 years.
Maybe you should delete this in case I don't find anything.
Hey, now negative results are still valuable.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's hard to say. It's hard to hear that when you're a PhD.
Jennifer Carman from the University of Michigan is doing some interesting work on trying to understand how people make decisions about the environment and climate change. Jennifer, thanks a lot for the chat. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And now moving on to the third and final interview with the GCC graduate students. This one's with Molly Keogh, who's a PhD student at Tulane University. We're working on topics that were done by a lot of my colleagues when I was back at Utah State University, specifically relating to the delivery of sediment and wetlands and things like that. So great to have a chance to get back in these discussions with Molly. Here we go. Me and Molly Keogh talking about living in Louisiana and wetlands. Molly Keogh from Tulane University. Thanks a lot for coming on today.
Thank you, Michael. I'm excited for this opportunity.
My wife spent one summer at Tulane before she moved to Cornell for her undergraduate degree. And she grew up in Metairie. And I was just back down there for a wedding a little while ago, enjoying the like not yet blazing hot climate. How are you dealing with being down in Tulane and New Orleans? Is it? I mean, climate wise, it seems a bit grim. How are you coping?
Well, it's quite warm. It's quite mm-hmm. humid. I grew up in Oregon.
Oh man!
So it was a bit of a shock to move to the south to the heat and humidity. But after my first year, I felt like I had really acclimated a little bit. And it's always nice to be able to get out on the marsh
yeah.
and get a sea breeze.
Whereabouts in Oregon are you from?
I grew up in Corvallis.
Oh, no kidding. I do you know, I probably don't, but a lot of people from my background are there. Dick Waring was a sort of a famous forester and Bev Law are out there and Ed Brook, a lot of folks out there.
I know Ed
Brook.
Oh,
you do? Okay, yeah.
I
visited Ed out there maybe 2009. Corvallis seems like a beautiful, slightly off the beaten path town.
Yeah.
It's not on the coast, but it's pretty close to the coast. So you're in the wet part of Oregon, right?
Yes. So yeah. It's in the Willamette Valley. So just under an hour from the coast mm-hmm. and about the same from the Cascade Mountains. So it's a nice place to reach a lot of different environments.
When I was there, the microbrew revolution was largely confined to Portland, I think. I mean, there is a little bit going mm-hmm. on in Corvallis. Has the plague of microbrews spread now to your hometown?
Oh, definitely. And it has spread to New Orleans as well since I've moved there or in the time that I was moving there.
But I mean, I guess for your work, you're not typically based in the city. It sounds like you're out on the Delta quite a bit looking at marsh issues.
Yes, definitely. Although I have to say that it doesn't take much to get from the city to the marsh. My field site is only about 30 river kilometers upstream. Uh-huh. So it's a pretty quick commute.
I mean, your initial interests as an undergrad were in classical geology. Can you describe the voyage from that background, which I guess you could have pursued in a variety of ways, including in, let's say, petroleum engineering or petroleum geology, to where you are now in your PhD program?
I've loved rock since I was a little kid. I was one of those kids who had just collect so many rocks that I would just dawdle under the weight. I didn't want to give any of them up. And so when I first learned that geologist was a thing, that's what I wanted to do. And of course, I forgot about it and did other things and came back to that as an undergrad at University of Oregon. Mm-hmm. It was a great program. It got me outside. It got me to see things, you know, right in my own backyard. I loved it. But I also loved the living world. I was looking for something that would connect the two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My mom was an ecologist, and so we always learned about birds and trees and, you know, just part of growing up.
Was she an academic?
She started with Fisheries and Wildlife.
I see, okay.
The Department of Fish and Wildlife. And now she works for Oregon State University as a science communicator. Mm-hmm. But so that was just part of my growing up, and I searched for a while for both the way that would connect the physical world and the living world, but also something that would be relevant to everyday people in my community, in whatever community I was in. And I loved my undergrad education and the projects that I did as an undergrad, but I was looking for something that was a little more relevant to society.
Than traditional geology.
Well, certainly lots of traditional geology is very relevant. But for me, I was the projects that I was doing weren't quite there.
Yeah.
And so for me, I was looking for something that was, I guess, pressing to the people around me. And I really found that with wetland science. And wetlands are so important around the world. It doesn't really matter what community you're in. They are important for so many ecosystem services.
I mean, I guess particularly where you are, you're at this intersection of a lot of fascinating history and modern processes. I mean, you have this long-term issue about the channelization and the retention of the Mississippi River and its changing sediment loads. You have issues of sea level rise and oil exploration and dredging of waterways in the Delta there, and some absolutely eye-popping rates of relative sea level rise, at least I say largely due to land subsidence issues combined with local sea level rise itself. And then you have other issues about, I'm sure, long-term isostatic adjustment and things like this. How do you, when you have a situation like that, it seems like a challenge to really figure out what chunk of that is sufficiently compelling for you to say, this is what I'm going to do. What was your process of honing down to one part of that huge question for your work?
Oh, that's tough. you're right. It's a really, really complicated issue in the Mississippi River Delta. There's so many competing factors and interests, and it's such an important ecological area and economic area and cultural area, and so many competing factors. But no one person can tackle all of that.
No, definitely not. Yeah,
you just got to pick something and do your best with that. And I think something that a lot of the coastal community is doing now, coastal science community, is trying to tease out those different impacts. And so how much is subsidence and how much is local eustatic sea level mm-hmm. rise? And so just trying to tease those apart and see which ones we can tackle. And so the one that I'm working on, tackling in my own small corner, is how we can restore sediment delivery to the wetland and how that can combat this whole myriad of processes that ends up with this really high rate of relative sea level rise.
So what should I understand about your particular field sites and the exact questions you're looking at? What have your initial findings been about this interaction of sediment delivery and the other processes controlling subsidence?
So one thing that I think is really special about Louisiana is that it is a red state, and yet the legislature has unanimously passed this coastal master plan that targets the restoration and protection of the coast, and it acknowledges sea level rise and that it is accelerating. And so not only are we acknowledging that, we are identifying projects and completing these projects to combat that sea level rise and to protect our coast. And that, I think that's a really special, it's a really amazing thing for Louisiana as a state.
You mean because of the local politics in Louisiana, that it is a very red state, yeah.
And it's in large part because people see this in their own backyard.
Yeah,
and
right.
They see it over their own lifespan and their family's lifespan. So this taps into my interest in dealing with an issue that is of interest to the local community, that people really see that they're losing their land. And that's really both sad and an economic problem for people.
In Louisiana, these coastal systems, these marshes, these deltas, what does it actually look like when someone loses their land, as you say? Does it just go underwater? Does it disintegrate? Does it erode away? Or is it all that stuff going on simultaneously?
Oh, it's probably all of that stuff. I think in large part it really disintegrates, though. The fisheries is such a big deal there, and so I'm not a fisheries biologist, mm-hmm. but I know there's more marsh edge. There's more fisheries habitat, but only up to a point, and then once that collapses, there's no marsh and there's no fisheries. So everybody agrees that we need to do something. It's just It's more challenging to pin down exactly what we need to do.
And is your work looking specifically at some of these approaches to try and mitigate this destruction? Or are you looking more at the sort
yes.
of, okay, it is. Yeah, yeah. So what's your specific take for your PhD? What are you investigating?
One of the key methods to restore some of the wetlands in the Mississippi Delta in this coastal master plan are river diversions. And that's where sediment-laden water is diverted from the river and out into the marsh in an attempt to kind of restore some of these natural processes that used to occur before the river was levied. So I'm looking at how sediment is delivered to the marsh and then how much of it is actually retained within wetlands and how that varies with water discharge. The goal is, in terms of restoration, the goal is to be able to trap as much sediment as possible on the marsh platform in a targeted area in order to build land in that area.
What's your interaction like with the Army Corps of Engineers? Or maybe more broadly, what's the interaction like between your field academically and the Army Corps of Engineers, who historically have been the government agency, I think anyway, that has been in charge of some of the channelization efforts that have, to some degree, starved the delta of sediment? Are they now kind of coming around? Are they active supporters and participants, or is it more separate?
I don't work directly with the Army Corps, but they were instrumental in the building of this diversion.
Oh, interesting.
And the other
yeah.
ones that are, yeah, that are in operation and in planning stages now. So yeah, they are an integral part, and their role is shifting from just this very, well, I have to be careful because I'm not from Louisiana, and so my history only goes back so far. But my impression is that this, primary goal of just levee building to expanding into a more multi-pronged approach to coastal land protection.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, it seems like the kind of thing. I mean, aren't we looking at multiple tens of centimeters of land subsidence per year, or have I got the rates wrong?
Coastwide in Louisiana, the rate of relative sea level rise is an average of 13 millimeters a year.
13 millimeters. So I was only off by an order of magnitude. That's not too bad.
Well, but still, when you think about what kind of low elevation, you know, the whole lower Mississippi Delta plain is so low elevation that, you know, if you have 13 millimeters a year, that adds up, and that's a lot of horizontal land distance lost every year.
And that's something like four times the global mean rate. So it's still an incredibly alarming rate of sea level rise.
It's very alarming, yes. And it's about nine, on average, of course, it's very spatially variable, but about 9 millimeters per year of that is subsidence.
My goodness, so almost, was that two-thirds of it is just subsidence? Is a subsidence from oil extraction, or is it just natural deltaic processes that happen to be in a subsiding phase now?
All of the above. Again, there's a lot of competing processes. Mm-hmm. So yes, some fluid extraction, oil and gas, but also groundwater, especially in within the city of New Orleans. Groundwater extraction is a big deal. As we pump our streets dry, we pump out the groundwater to keep the city from flooding. The subsidence increases dramatically.
You know, something that's been coming out a lot in the pages of Nature and Science, but now across huge non-science fields, is just the degree to which women working in remote locations, like field sites or in Antarctica, for example, can be vulnerable to sexual harassment. And it seems, at least in the U.S., to have exploded in terms of visibility and discussion within about the past month. And of course, there's this incredibly famous case now with Jane Willenbring in her work in Antarctica that came out on Science a little while ago. I mean, what's the sense now about people and your cohort who are working in the field extensively? I mean, is this a major point of discussion and something that a lot of women are having to face, or is it not something that's been a huge issue for you and your colleagues?
I have to say that for me personally, I've been very lucky, and I have not personally had any of any problems with sexual harassment of any kind in my work, which is really, I'm lucky, and I think it's surprisingly rare, it turns
wow,
out.
Yeah.
Which is terrible. But I have been lucky to have just a wonderful set of advisors and mentors and colleagues. But I hear a lot of stories, and I think people do feel particularly vulnerable in the field when, you know, some of the normal boundaries of an office situation break down.
It's often the combination of isolation and power dynamics, and in some cases, I'm certainly not all, but it can be alcohol as well.
Yes.
Do you feel like academia at this stage, at the graduate student level, is providing essentially the resources for reporting and discussing and raising these issues in a way that doesn't turn the situation around on the person who is being abused?
I think they're trying, and I don't think they're there yet.
Yeah.
I think there's a long ways to go. It's really easy to say, you know, bring your concerns, there will be no repercussions. But lots of times it seems like it ends up in, you know, you have to, whoever the individual is who's been harassed or you know, the ultimate solution is to leave, is to remove yourself from the situation.
Right, change yeah. fields.
And it doesn't go the other way.
No.
Yeah, or certainly institutions. And it doesn't go the other way that the harasser has to change institutions.
Coming back a little bit to your own particular career path, I know that you had a time when you were working in an industry. How did you decide to stop doing that and come back into grad school? Was it just this desire you had discussed previously about wanting to get back to living things and working more with the outdoors and having that different experience?
So I was working in environmental consulting, and actually I was both working with the living environment. I was essentially the wildlife biologist at a newly constructed wind farm. So keeping an eye on how this wind farm affected the wildlife, which was not much, really.
Mostly avian impacts or broad spectrum?
Avian and bat were the big ones.
Okay.
And, you know, when I got the job, I thought, oh, this is going to be kind of depressing. But it turns out that it's the wind farms these days are sited very well. They do a lot of pre-construction surveys. And so the fatalities are, the average is 2 birds per turbine per year.
Hmm.
If you think about how many birds a cat or a car or a tall building kills.
Right. It's not much compared to that.
So anyway, it was a wonderful job. I was outside in the eastern foothills of the Cascade Mountains in Washington State. I was following a very strict survey and reporting protocol for this post-construction wildlife monitoring. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, there's some really interesting questions that we were looking at. But as I was going through the project and got more familiar with it and kind of took it from the beginning, you know, through to the report writing, I realized that there were questions that I wish I could ask but didn't really have the freedom is just a, you know, just kind of a boots on the ground person
to
ask those questions.
Right.
And it was at that point that I thought, you know, I want to go back to school so that I can kind of build on that creativity and ask the questions that I'm really interested in.
I mean, I have friends who work in environmental consulting, and one thing that really strikes me is the degree to which they are on billable hours. I'm not saying that that's what it was like for you, but they would literally have no ability to investigate interesting questions that were not specifically tied to a project. So I can
yeah,
see that
exactly.
Once you have that draw, that itch, you need to get back into school, I suppose.
Yeah, and you never know when you jump into something, you never know what's going to turn up exactly. You never know if there's going to be something interesting and unexpected that you want to kind of take a left turn and follow that. And in the confines of environmental consulting, you're answering a specific set of questions, and that's important.
Yeah.
But I did miss that creativity and that ability to sort of follow my nose and my interests.
I mean, that's the great part about academia is you can drop everything and pivot completely to a different question.
Right. You think you're starting out doing something, and then you learn a little and you think, oh, but wait, it goes this way. And then you learn a little more, and then you turn the other way.
So where do you see yourself after you get out of your PhD program at Tulane? Do you think you'll be pursuing academic jobs, or do you see yourself going into, you know, launching your own consulting company?
Maybe neither, but I don't want to close any doors for myself. I'm particularly interested in government agencies that you know, perhaps the USGS or NOAA or something like that. Although I do love teaching in a way that I never expected to. I've had some really rewarding experiences passing on knowledge and getting students excited about stuff.
Are you TAing now, or are you running your own classes?
I'm TAing. I teach mineralogy and petrology labs to undergraduates.
Do you have friends, colleagues who are working in those government agencies you mentioned now, like, for example, at NOAA or EPA or any of these other agencies?
I do work with a scientist from the USGS and another from the National Wildlife Federation. I have a lot of family friends that I grew up with who work for Fish and Wildlife and for NOAA and for EPA. So I've kind of seen those, you know, as the, you know, the older generation, what their experiences have been like. And it's interesting to imagine what perhaps my experiences might be like.
What's the gestalt now? If you think collectively about all of your friends and colleagues, family who are working in these agencies in the current administration, I mean, are they kind of going about business as usual? Are they thinking about leaving their jobs? Are they thrilled with the way that things are going?
Oh, I don't think anybody's thrilled with the way things are going.
I'm sure Scott Pruitt is, though.
True. Yes. No, nobody that I work closely with on a day-to-day basis. It seems like there's a lot more uncertainty in the future and what kind of funding there might be, what kind of job openings in the future. Even if people are confident in their own jobs, they don't know if they will get research support in terms of money or field support. Or
would you think about going international? I mean, for example, I've been at a meeting in oceanography in China, and I happened to stumble upon this gigantic meeting on wetlands. And I know that across many fields, China is hiring like no one else in the world is hiring. What do you think about that?
Definitely. One of the cool things about wetlands is that they are all around the world and they are important all around the world.
Molly, thanks very much for the chat today and best wishes for the completion of your PhD.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So concludes the first ever three-part interview on Forecast. Thanks again to Henri for suggesting the format, and to Jennifer and Molly for being so willing to come on. And again, for grad students out there, this is a fantastic meeting. It's the Graduate Climate Conference, or GCC. This is the 11th edition and should be switching back, I believe, to the University of Washington next year. As you probably remember, the initial plan for this episode had been to have Sonia Senavaratne from ETH Zurich on, but Sonia got a bit of a cold, so we pushed that back. In the meantime, I've already recorded an interview with Abigail Swan from the University of Washington. And Abigail does quite a bit of work on interactions of CO2, climate change, and the land surface itself. So we'll be having that interview posting next time. That was a great one. And then, yes, we'll have Sonia probably in the one following Abby's interview. Coming up soon anyway. And then, of course, I'm off for Thanksgiving. So I think we're having 15 people over. It'll be a massive cooking extravaganza. And as always, the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guests, and not necessarily those of Nature or Springer Nature, our parent company. I'll talk to you soon.